So it's a double joy to be here. First of all, thanks to Lars and the organizers to let me stay here for a couple of weeks and do research. And second of all, to enjoy Ken Nomoto's birthday. So I hope that this research will reignite interest in some of the aspects of the supernovae from a little bit different perspective. I have plenty of slides, so some of them there will be really 5 seconds, 10 seconds. That's the outline of my talk. I will start with the overview of the field and then move on to the problems. That's, of course, the motivation for this research. There are several reasons why we are interested in supernovae, starting from probably cosmology and chemistry. Then this theory was developed over the last 40 years, and each 10 years gives you a new qualitative change in the field, ending up with the three-dimensional simulations in 2000 and later. That explosive zoo is really the D family, okay? So I played with the PowerPoint, and you across the models you find a D letter, and that's because that's double, that's the deflagration, the detonation. You look for those Ds, and they are all over the place. Probably the models that don't have D in the name are wrong from the beginning. Now, there is an eye-opener provided to me by Evald Miller, TimeGo, and that's what do we mean by actually simulation. And we need to understand that very carefully, and some part of my talk will be devoted just to that. So I hope that you finish reading, so I'm not in position to repeat that. But the last part is really nice. These show the pleasure which he took in simulating truth. So when we are simulating, there is some relevance to the truth, hopefully. And let's remember about the problems that are involved here. So one is, of course, that we deal with the initial conditions, and we deal with very large-scale simulations, meaning simulations have a potential of producing arbitrarily complex, unverifiable results. And if you go to the terabyte data sets, that's, of course, one of those possibilities. The other one is that we need to remember the computer models are becoming more realistic. They are not realistic. So there is a tendency of pretending that if I do a three-dimensional complex simulation, it's realistic. So we have done some simulations in the past, and being in Garching is nice because you're embedded in very vigorous, rich environment. And one is modeled by Krizek, Beringer, and Miller. This is the convection inside the elliptical galaxy to look into cooling flows. And they impose certain initial conditions, and they end up with some of the results. And this result looks like the initial conditions, okay? Now, so the question is posed by my supervisor in Poland, what happens if the perturbations are random? So that's what happens, okay? You end up with the convection, which doesn't look like the initial conditions at all, okay? So this is one of the points that you need to keep in mind, that the initial conditions are important. And when it comes to that dipole flow and things that happened at very early times, if you add a little bit of rotation, you break that symmetry. So we are probably not looking really into dipolar flows unless there are some other things involved. So that's a part of the summary provided by Richard Larson, who is one of the pioneers of modeling, you know, those 20 zones, Lagrangian codes, doing protostars and star formation. So perhaps the most important contribution of numerical techniques to science has been that they have often discovered new phenomena and so on. And even systems governed by simple laws can quickly develop a level of complexity that suppress our ability to form a simple mental picture of a model. So those are things that we need to keep in mind when talking about simulations. And there was some, I think someone quoted Eddington already before. So there's that 1 plus 1 equals 2. And even if we understand 1 and 1, then that plus is also important. So when we put things together, linear, that can become very quickly nonlinear. So we need to study that very carefully. And the ones that we don't understand are numerous. Okay, so it's not like I go out and I do the model and it looks great and, you know, that's it. No, there are all those ones that we need to answer. And one of them is, of course, the initial conditions. So already Fritz brought that up. There is also work by Hefrick and Stein that's heavily under-resolved. Nevertheless, they demonstrate that actually form some sparks, those first models, those first flames. And then we have work about, you know, whether we are off-center, whether we are at the very center and so on. So starting with work by Jens, Wolfgang, and Stan in 96, that was actually motivated more by the previous paper, I think by Domingo and Stan. And we find those growing bubbles, off-center bubbles, violently rising to the center, to the surface later. And then what you need to do is just to sit, watch the simulation going off, and that's the end result. So that was me some time ago, but that was really long time ago. initial conditions so far, I think there's a strong evidence that we don't know what is actually happening there, okay? We have some educated guesses. So, Fritz already summarized some of the problems of the deflagration, so I'm not going to dwell on this. We know there is a problem with pure deflagration, and there is lots of evidence accumulating in that direction, so it would be nice if that evidence is actually explained. I think some of those points are, for example, about high-velocity features, smooth cores, they are rich in iron group elements. So those are things that are difficult to get in the deflagrations. Those are old models I'm not going to discuss, whether you know the model that was 5 years ago is the same one that we have today. But Garching and Barcelona and Vadim and Alexei were producing those models, and they were demonstrating that actually we have some low-velocity carbon that is not actually observed. And then if we enhance that, boost that with detonation, then this problem seems to disappear, at least to some extent. So the preferred scenario for those is that we start with some mild ignition, go through the deflagration phase, and then somehow miraculously detonation happens. Okay. So what is DFD? The models that I presented last year, or this year, because the paper just appeared, those are actually delayed detonations. There is no big philosophy behind this. You just need to find what is the fuse, okay? What are the initial conditions? You choose one of the, 15 available choices. I chose one. The other one is what is the fuse that you produce? I think I know what the fuse is, or, I would like to think that's the fuse. If you think about the model that's like, asteroid hitting the ocean on the Earth, so it creates that large wave that goes around the star and erupts it and eventually explodes. So I don't want to show you models that are single bubble, that's double bubble, that one of the bubbles goes off north, one to the south, so they will be emerging immediately, and you will see the burnt ash. They actually clash together around the equator. I wanted to break the symmetry and see whether I still can produce some detonation in that way. That was successful. It apparently produced some detonation. You see expansion of the stars, so the density goes down. There's detonation that sweeps through the material, burns it completely. There will be very low material unburnt left in the system. It will be also energetic. So some DFD-related work that goes back to Vadim, of course, and Alexei. Fritz did something last year. I'm going to talk about this model a little bit more. And there are recent applications by Bob Thiessen, and that's also Alexei involved, and Peter Heflich, and we have those recent models that Fritz covered just a minute before. So let's talk about Fritz's paper, because that was interesting paper. That was paper on topic that I was interested in, and I tried to read that, and instead of trying to verify whether they did something good or not, I tried to understand it. Okay. So one thing is that the resolution used in those models is terribly low. Okay, it's certainly substandard. So if you run the model with resolution 10 times lower than what is accepted, then I don't think that you are going to find the same behavior as in the result model. So I don't think those models are really resolved. And that gets worse in three dimensions, okay? So this is 700 kilometer region that goes off or not. So this is a huge region. This is like one third of the progenitor, okay? So you need to understand there's lots of space in that volume that things may happen one way or another. Simplified approach to detonation means you need to define what you mean by detonation. So what they find is actually they use some description. You need to have high density and high temperature, but this is just sufficient. This is not a sufficient, this is necessary condition for detonation. So there is a criterion used. There's also no feedback from nuclear burning. This is a system that goes, that approaches detonation, okay? It's a long process, it lasts. In my simulations, I see that happening over 0.4, 0.5 seconds, where you are actually waiting for the system to go up. So that's one set of the problems. The second is, there is a certain correlations that you find in that system, okay? So the one correlation is the further you put that bubble off, the higher the temperature they get in the detonation region. And that's fine. But then when you look into three-dimensional simulations, then you find that the bubble that is closer to the center is actually producing a result that is not consistent with 200-kilometer bubble, okay? So this one that is further out in three dimensions produces more energy, which is counterintuitive. It's not consistent with two-dimensional results. So the final thing is numerical. I think that's the final thing. It's numerical convergence. I don't understand the first part of the table. It doesn't seem to make much sense to me. But the second one shows that actually when you increase the resolution, then the detonation is more likely, and you also release less energy. By the way, at the same moment, the resolution is actually higher. So that's the region where the detonations are available to you. And that actually means that if you increase resolution, the likelihood of transiting to detonation is higher. So my modest hope is that we will see some realistic better result models in this case. And I thought it has to be a strong message. So that's the only way that I can actually present this. So there are models, of course, that this DFD model that I produced. So a few words on that. There's deflagration, transition, and detonation. And let's make some comment about the deflagration phase itself. And that goes back to Cabot and Cook. That's the recent paper that appeared just last December. There is a problem with the initial conditions that they identified. They do like larger scale, three-dimensional, 3,000 cube simulation of Ray Taylor. Okay? So they say if you put the system on a certain trajectory, it will follow the trajectory. And this is consistent with what I showed you just from those simulations of convection and elliptical galaxies, that the initial conditions determined the outcome. So our ignorance regarding initial conditions is influencing those models. The second is, it seems prudent to ensure that the model for thermal and flame speed faithfully reproduces RTI physics before invoking other schemes to increase the bearing rate, such as multi-point ignition, background turbulence from thermal convection, and on deflagration to detonation transition. So the call is go back to the drawing board, do basic physics research. Okay. So let's talk about the deflagration in the model. One is that, of course, as we agree with Fritz, I think this is a common theme. The control in the system is driven by deflagration. So that's the essential part of that. And the expansion sets the initial conditions for the detonation. Okay. The transition to detonation will be covered by Vadim. Several models. I think the one that really Elaine likes is Swelser. But I'm not going to talk much about this. This is probably the following talk. In our case, what I found is that this, what happens in the system is actually shock to detonation transition. It's a strong volumetric explosion, okay, that you have shockwave already present, you compress the gas, and it goes off. In some cases, you also have other waves involved in the process. So there are different ways you can do this in the lab, channels, open channels, and also something that I like most, and that's pulse detonation engine, that some of the processes that are visible in this DFD scenario are actually present. However, I think the most relevant is actually inertial confinement fusion. So I find that very nice parallel between our supernova research and pure energy that we can probably generate here on Earth. And that's the example from the recent work by Smoliuk that actually shows you the pellet. Okay, that's the region that is compressed by laser ablation. And that's the peak compression. So you see that region is really highly unstable. And even though we try to very hard to make it clean and uniform and so on, the instabilities are so strong that you actually don't control it very well. So if we don't control it here on Earth, you need to understand that in turbulent environment in stars, that's even worse. Okay. And that's the perturbations, and that's the outcome in different cases, depending on perturbations. People study that also in simulations, the same process. In our case, if I perturb stochastically using the same code, deflagration phase, I get the output that differs by almost 0.1 fold, okay? So the deflagrations are not really stable in any way. This code is not predictive code, so to speak. And that's a very strong message that I want to send to this community. Don't believe those calculations as you do or you used to, okay? Those are not really controllable things. And I think Fritz's work is one of the examples, and this work is another example of that. So there is detonation phase also involved, and for those who didn't read my paper, I'm using Alpha Network to actually follow the nucleosynthesis in that, and so it's very expensive, and that picture of a cat laying back, that's very, very relevant here because it takes really a lot of time to calculate that. So let me go to the final properties of the models, and that table actually shows nucleosynthesis. This is very approximate, of course. This is Alpha Network, okay? So I cannot, for example, break the IGE, this Eigengrund elements, into what we know it should be, so radioactive stuff and stabilized stops. Nevertheless, what we can try to see is that we are producing some of the intermediate elements here. We produce lots of iron group elements, okay, and basically there is almost fully burned stuff when it comes to fuel. So we need to validate that, Okay, and that's one of the problems, again, with our modeling. We don't take those models seriously enough to compare to observations. When we do that, we usually stop at light curves. We sometimes go to spectroscopy, very rarely to spectropolarimetry, which is, I think, essential to understand the structure of the ejecta. So it's good to have good collaborators, and Dan Kazin is here. I very much appreciate your contribution to this work, but also to my life in many ways. So let's see what we can do together. First, look at the morphology of the ejecta. It has a composite structure that is outermost, smooth layer. Okay, then we have outer, intermediate mass element shell, and then we have smooth core. Okay, so that's the part that we see here. That's what we observe, and that's the kind of clumpy structure that's surrounding the smooth core. So, yes. Okay, 5 minutes. Very good. It's asymmetric, and I think this is what Lifang, Bader, and Patat conclude from their observations from their sample, that this is a morphology that you would like to see in the right models. So we analyzed it from the point of view of spectropolarimetry. I think we are not very happy about what we see, that there is some low-velocity things, highly polarized, and that's the result of a sphericity of the core region. The light curves, they fit observations pretty well. I think that's the relatively easy part in this model. However, the overall model is too bright by 0.35 magnitudes, so those light curves were actually adjusted, but the shape is okay. So that's, you see also some orientation effects in the system, and I think this is thanks to Dan's contribution that you can actually look at that single model from different directions, and you see strong variation. This is Phillips' relation. I don't think that we are actually producing spread that is strong enough to explain observations, but we are within the ballpark. Again, once you adjust for the luminosity, which is probably in this model a consequence of this approximate network that we have. There's also strong variation in B and U in this ultraviolet part, blue part of the spectrum, and that's because the core is actually asymmetric, so you see strong variation from angle. Opacity changes dramatically. There is also that intriguing observational fact brought up by Vanetti for the first time, that we have those rapid decliners and slow decliners when it comes to velocity expansion. And actually, you see that in our model once you look from different directions. So this is, again, a deflagration phase that is asymmetric induced by that. So when it comes to the high-velocity features, they are commonly observed in objects like Paolo Mazzali is advocating. We also tried to explain that, and it seems that this is actually an example of that 2001 EL versus 94D. You see the strong absorption here, the calcium line, and in our model, when you look from the side where you have that strong intermediate mass element shell in front of you, you actually see strong absorption, otherwise you don't. So surface pollution is one. There's also surface pollution possibly by seen in X-rays and supernova remnants. So this is actually nickel or iron at very high distances from the core, which seems to be separate completely from the rest of the ejecta. So there are those things that are intriguing, okay? High velocity features, polarimetry, that clumpy structure outside the smooth core, and also some indication, probably preliminary, but still indication, that there is high density burning products in the core of the ejecta. So let me propose a model, okay? And that's almost the end of my talk. Let's start with the Chandrasekhar mass model, okay? Carbon, oxygen, nothing special here. Let's consider convective rotating core, temperature fluctuations that are present there, and let's call them sparks, okay? So this is the structure. We have those sparks, we have highly turbulent structure, and rotation that actually induces a little bit of structure in that, asymmetry. So those bubbles are known to be unstable. And that's because if you have inviscid fluid and you have no tension in the system, those bubbles are not going to survive. And actually, right, and actually no one demonstrated that those bubbles are, how those bubbles are actually coming about, how they are created. So the bubbles are going to be shred, okay? So that also has some other consequences that there will be some heating in the core. The progenitor will pre-expand and lower central density. So that convective core will be consuming fuel, it will become rich in those iron group elements, stable ones, because burning is at very high densities, and that spark production will be moving to high radii. Okay? There, buoyancy is greater, okay, than in the core. So it's easy to remove that spark and prevent it from being shred by turbulence. So once that happens, I think you have successful overshoot, you have a bubble that goes out, and ignition. Okay? So that's what I think is happening during those first phases. So that gives us partially pre-expanded progenitor, stable IgEs in the core. It gives you also IgE composition that's possibly dependent on the history of that and global asymmetry due to rotation. That phase has to be studied with low Mach number flow solvers, and there is a poster by Zhu Zhang, and that's my summary. Thank you very much.
We had kind of speculated that from the polarization and asymmetry effects that you might account not for the Phillips relation but for the dispersion around the Phillips relation. So you seem to be disappointed that you and Dan didn't get a relation going along that. It seems to me you've just reinforced that issue that the asymmetry could account for a substantial amount of the currently observed scatter.
Right. I think that's what we think, that this is, you know, this is contribution to the dispersion. And this is a single model. So we need to understand that there are many opportunities to produce variety probably of objects. And you know, there's clearly what comes out from the validation of this model is a message that we need to work on certain aspects of that. And when it comes to the first step to improve this kind of models is nucleosynthesis. I think what Wolfgang obtained, that, you know, the IgEs are split in different way than in preliminary calculations, is a very strong message that we need to do nucleosynthesis better, in addition to the dozen of other things.
Other questions?
Yeah, so you commented quite a lot on our recent paper, and
you deserve that.
Right.
Very good.
I just wanted to mention that, of course, we also thought about these resolution issues, and we commented quite a lot in the paper on this, and it's not as simple as you put it here. So the substandard resolution, whatever that means, does not apply to the important phase where the burning takes place, and that is what decides on the most important parameter, how much you expand.
Correct.
And you cannot compare our resolution to your resolution because our blame model is different and we don't need as much resolution to get the same results. So therefore, the important burning phase is sufficiently resolved in these models. I'm pretty confident that we get the right answers here. Of course, the problem is the resolution when the collision takes place. And, well, this is of course an issue, but we still resolve this structure in this collision spot, and therefore I think we get about the right answers, and comparing to the results on the poster from the Chicago group, this is actually more or less confirmed. So therefore, I'm pretty confident that our resolution is not as bad that we cannot tell about the answers here. And the second comment was, you had this example of the two-sided bubbles. We did this in 3D, and in 3D, actually, we got a very decided unbinding of the star. So we don't see any detonation here because going with the burning to both sides, that even expands the star more, releases more energy, and that clearly unbinds the star.
So I think that strengthens the message that we need to understand the progressions better, because that controls really the evolution. On the other hand, I don't share your confidence if I put the bubble at 200 kilometers rather than 100, and I see completely different unpredictable result, and I think there is something that we need to understand better, okay, in this. And once we have that high resolution in the outer parts where the detonation may happen or may not happen, of course, on average, that object is spherically symmetric, okay? But on small scales, it is not. So it would be good to actually have a little bit more insight into that part.
Wolfgang, you need a microphone, I think.
Oh. No, he doesn't. But
No, he does. Everybody does. It's the rule.
Sure. Tomek.
Hi.
What I didn't like in your talk is that you give people the impression that there are problems where there are none. For instance, if you take inertially confined fusion as an example, to say, argue against the way the supernova is done, that's unfair. Inertial confined fusion is highly compressible, high Mach number flow. We are dealing with low Mach number flows, nearly incompressible. There are so many differences, so it's a very bad comparison, and you had many of those in your talk we could actually discuss for hours. You give people the impression that there are problems where there are no problems anymore, and where the problems have been solved. Sorry for that.
So the nice thing is that we don't have a robust model for the supernova explosion yet, okay? That's only the bottom message. Second of all, the inertial confinement fusion is compressible as the detonation transition to detonation. So I think
we have talked about the expectation that low and voltage of the expectation, not about the detonation. We're taking the inertial confinement fusion as the example to indicate that something is done wrong with the expectation.
No, this
how
is not
fast,
what I said. I think you misunderstood
how
me.
How fast does this turbulent flame move? The turbulent flame?
Yeah. Okay, despite that, I never said that ICF is related to deflagration. Okay, I said that was example to give you when we look into confined flow, where the transition to detonation happens. That's my message. Okay, this is a highly unstable phase of the evolution when you try to compress the fuel. Yes, Wolfgang.
Okay. Yeah. Are there other questions? Well, thank you very much,
thank
and
you.
I appreciated your healthy skepticism.